Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 17th of September 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's episode is number 13 and we will be looking at the Great Pyramid. But before we get into that, I will just start by reminding listeners that I am wanting to hear from you, the Radio Albion listeners, as an accusation has been made against me that what I say is likely to stir up hate. So I would like to hear from you how Radio Albion makes you feel, why you listen, and especially if you've been inspired to take any action. Particularly good is if you have been listening since the Radio Aryan days and can comment on any changes you may have noticed over the years. And if you can do that for me, and then please send it to stormersubs@hushmail.com, or you can add it to the Discus comments, or the chat room, or on Gab, or on Telegram, or any of the ways that you have to contact me. Just write a short piece about why you listen to Radio Albion and what you get out of it, and that will be really helpful for me. And I am very grateful to those of you who have already written in with those details. Right, well, today we're going to get into the Great Pyramid, and of course I am joined by my co-host, the Patriarch, once again. Patriarch, how are you doing? What's life like for you? Is it good?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Same as always. Yeah, not much has changed in the past week.
Well, that's good to hear. As I mentioned in the last episode, we haven't actually got any notes for this week, so this is all new to you as well as it is new to the listeners. And if the listeners want to check up on this, they really need to purchase these two books. We're going to be using A Study in Pyramidology by E. Raymond Capt, and we're also going to be using The Great Pyramid Decoded by E. Raymond Capt. And there's a lot of information in here which is beyond me. I'm not particularly good at mathematics and all that sort of thing, but it really is quite incredible the geometry that was involved in the creation of this Great Pyramid. And I think what we'll start with is the reference to it that is actually in the Bible. This is from Isaiah 19, chapter 19, verses 19 to 20. It says, "In that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar." And the Hebrew word matstiba, which is translated as pillar there, is correctly translated as monument. So it says, "And a monument at the border thereof to the Lord, and it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt." And according to that passage, this altar monument is to be found in the midst of the land of Egypt, and yet at the same time at the border thereof. There is only one spot on the face of the earth that complies with both of those conditions, and that is the exact spot where the Great Pyramid stands. The Great Pyramid is situated on a line corresponding with the 30 degrees north latitude drawn just south of Cairo, dividing the country into Lower and Upper Egypt. To the immediate east of the pyramid is highly cultivated and densely populated land in which stands the metropolis of Egypt. To the immediate west of the pyramid is the Great Sahara Desert, nothing but sand for many hundreds of miles. Lines produced from the two diagonals of the pyramid to the northwest and the northeast enclose the Nile Delta, which resembles an open fan with a long handle. The Delta, or Lower Egypt, is the fan. The strip of cultivated land which borders the Nile is the handle. The Great Pyramid stands at the geometric centre and southern extremity of this Nile Delta quadrant. Thus, we can see the Great Pyramid is in the midst of the land of Egypt, and yet it is also at the border of it, both geometrically and geographically. The Great Pyramid was also placed in the exact centre of all the land area of the earth. Lines drawn through the north-south and east-west axis of the pyramid divide equally the earth's terrain. The north-south axis, which is 31.9 degrees meridian east of Greenwich, is the longest land meridian, and the east-west axis, 29 degrees 58 by 51 north, is the longest land parallel. It should also be noted that the official name of the Great Pyramid is the Great Pyramid of Giza, which means in English, the Great Pyramid of the Border. This gives additional proof that the altar of Isaiah 19, verse 19 to 20, is the Great Pyramid of Giza. According to Isaiah, this altar was to be for a sign and a witness. This indicates that it was not an altar of sacrifice, in which case it could not have been built of hewn stone. For the law has never been receded that is given in Exodus 20, verse 25, if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. So we can see there is a reference to a monument in the middle of Egypt, which is supposed to be a monument to the Lord God. And I wonder how many of our listeners have ever heard that before, or whether you had ever heard that before, Patriarch.
No, that is news to me. But I mean, my initial questions would be, well, first of all, we're talking about the Great Pyramid of Giza, and the two other pyramids next to it, right?
Yeah, and I think they may well have been built by different builders or at different times, but they're a part of the same complex.
Right. I mean, my initial understanding of those was that they kind of reflect Orion's belt as well. The land with the stars and that, but it's a very interesting scriptural quote. I guess what would be the from that? How can we see where the similarities would be if there's a monument kind of created to glorify God? Are there any similarities or assimilations which we can kind of draw upon, which connect the two together, the two cultures, like in terms of the ancient Hebrews and then the Great Pyramid of Giza?
Yes, there are, and we'll get to that near the end. But also, I mean, you're saying, what is the witness to God? Well, it's the impossibility of them building it, of anybody building in all the information that is encoded into that pyramid at the time, which we will see here. And then you've also got the references to Christ being the cornerstone that the builders rejected. And the pyramid itself, we can see from the four socket points that when they actually built it, they deliberately built it with a slight curvature. It was slightly out when they first laid the first course. All the other courses are slightly out, which meant that the final capstone itself, which would have had sides of about 30 feet, which would have been a solid pyramid capstone, the capstone wouldn't fit because the pyramid had been deliberately built slightly out. And this is the reason why there's these references to Christ being the cornerstone that the builders rejected, and it's referring to the cornerstone of the pyramid. You know, when you hear that, you think, oh, it means the corner of a wall, but that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But when you think of it being that corner stone, that pointed stone that is the cap of the pyramid, then it does make sense. So we've got those two bits there, and also we'll go into who the builders were at the end of it, at the end of the quote.
So the quick question is, how do we know that it was missing and it wasn't kind of like eroded away or it was damaged?
Because all the records have said that it was never there. They never built it. We have records of it being built, basically, which we will get into. Just to get into the next quote, which is about the geometric construction of the pyramid. It is not by hieroglyphics nor by sculpture work, but by symbol, measure, and angle that the Great Pyramid of Giza in the land of Egypt yields its secret. Scientifically directed surveys have furnished the actual geometric measurements of the pyramid. From these measurements, calculated data was obtained, which revealed the Great Pyramid to constitute a geometrical representation on a vast scale of mathematical and astronomical knowledge not to be known again for over 4,500 years. The remarkable manner in which this knowledge is geometrically expressed relative to certain simple mathematical formulae surpasses in every way any similar undertaking of man. The unit of measure employed in the actual construction of the Great Pyramid was the Egyptian royal cubit. However, the linear unit predominating in the design of the pyramid is the sacred cubit, which is shown on the boss in the antechamber. And in the antechamber, there is like a lump that comes out of the wall, and it's basically the sacred cubit. A scientific examination of the sacred cubit found it to bear an exact relationship to the size of the planet on which we live. This cubit is the exact 10 millionth part of the distance from the center of the Earth to the pole, or the semi-axis. According to the results of the latest geodetic research in the International Geophysical Year of 1957 to 1958, the polar radius of the Earth, as deduced from observations of the orbits of artificial satellites, is approximately 3949.89 miles. Divide this figure by 10 million and the result is one sacred cubit, or 25 pyramid inches, or 25.0265 British inches. Thus, the Earth's polar radius measures 10 million sacred cubits, or 250 million pyramid inches. Hence, the pyramid inch is the 500 millionth part of the Earth's polar diameter. And I'll just stop there because it's interesting that the British inch is slightly out, and they do actually have a note there, and they say when the Pilgrim Fathers and early British settlers went out to America, they took the British system of weights and measures with them, but already in the United States, these have deviated slightly from the original. Expressed in units of the metric system, the British inch is equivalent to 25.399978 millimetres, while the present USA inch is 25.400051 millimetres. International industries have, however, unofficially adopted an inch of 25.4 millimetres. So they had it exactly right 4,500 years ago that the inch should be the size of, or this sacred cubit should be made up of 25 pyramid inches, but it's actually made up of 25.0265 British inches. So they had that correct back then, and we already mm-hmm. have it slightly out now. I don't know if you want to comment on that before I continue.
No, it's going over my head a little bit, to be honest. It's lots of numbers and stuff.
It's mind-boggling, isn't it, really? I mean, I've had to read this a few times to sort of properly understand it, I think. If this method of arriving at a measure of distance seems unusual, consider the French meter, conceived as a unit of linear measure based also upon the size of the Earth. The French meter was arrived at by taking the 10 millionth part of the so-called quadrant of the Earth, as calculated from the North Pole to the equator, along a meridian passing through Dunkirk. As the Earth is not a perfect sphere, the said distance is not a true quadrant. Hence, it is not truly scientific to determine a unit of straight measure from such a surface. The calculations were subsequently found to be slightly in error. Thus, the designer of the Great Pyramid long forestalled modern man in the scientific idea of having a unit of measure based on the size of the Earth, and therefore must have known the exact dimensions of the Earth. It is amazing to what a small extent the original perfect inch, as well preserved in the Great Pyramid, has fluctuated down through the ages. The inch, as now used in Britain, after all these long centuries, only deviates from the original scientific standard by approximately a thousandth part of an inch. The USA inch, differing insignificantly from the British inch, may be regarded as being practically identical. As we go back into history, we find that the British inch deviated even less from the original true scientific inch of the Great Pyramid, and it is not unlikely that it was, in fact, derived from it. And, you know, this makes me wonder whether they had measuring rulers that they were carrying about, because Stonehenge was also built to this sacred cubit. And I wonder what other structures were as well.
Yes, interesting to think how they came about with the measurements. My initial thought would be, did they find some way of harmonizing it with nature, you know, to determine where, like we get pi, how we get Fibonacci sequence, and we see the same patterns and that, say, for example, like a snail shell or a daffodil and whatnot. They all have the same kind of ratios. in patterns within them. I just wonder if they abstracted from nature some kind of system or method that enabled them to keep measurements the same and consistent. I think I watched a video somewhere where they, I think it might have actually been Egypt, same documentary which talked about this proposed method of building the pyramids, but I'm pretty sure that they said they used water droplets to get a kind of the perfect diameter. But, I'd have to go back and watch that, but yeah, it could be a possibility anyway to just extrapolate from nature.
That's a really good point, that there may have been something else that they were using to actually get this measurement from, rather than, you know, working out exactly half the size of the Earth. Because what they're basically saying is from the center of the Earth to the top of the Earth, and then you divide that by 10 million, and then that's how you get to the pyramid inch. So maybe there was something else that was also based upon the size of the Earth that was much smaller, but we don't know what it was.
Yeah, and I guess formulating a general principle that the rest of nature follows.
Yeah, it would all be tied in, wouldn't it? You know, all of nature's tied in. So it's very possible that there was something and we just don't know what it was, and we're just using the size of the Earth to do it today. It is worthy of special note that the entire geometric structure of the pyramid is designed on the basis of pi, 3.14159. the mathematical ratio upon which the whole physical universe is designed, and also the value of the year, 365.242, the number of days in Earth's solar year, the time interval in days between two successive vernal equinoxes in the Earth's journey around the sun. So again, that's slightly out, isn't it? 365.242, not a whole number. In mathematics, pi, the 16th letter of the Greek alphabet, is the ratio between the circumference of a circle and its diameter, which is the straight line through its center. That is to say, the circumference of any sized circle is always 3.14159 times its diameter. This sign has been adopted because of the fact that the ratio in question has never been ascertained to its finality, although of course it has been calculated to an exceedingly high degree of precision, namely to over 5,000 decimal places. The amazing fact that this geometric ratio, pi, which pervades the whole universe from the vast solar systems to the tiniest atoms, also pervades the Great Pyramid, was first revealed by the angle of the slope of the pyramid's sides. This angle results in the pyramid's vertical height bearing the same ratio to the perimeter of its base that the radius of a circle bears to its circumference. In other words, if the height of the pyramid to its apex is taken to be the radius of a circle, the distance around the pyramid is found to be exactly equal to the circumference of that circle. The required angle of the slope of the pyramid's sides to produce this result is consequently known as the pyramidic or pi angle, and it is 51 degrees, 14.3 inches, inches. No other pyramid in the world is built at this angle. And interestingly enough, you take that angle there, the 51 degrees, and if you were to put the pyramid on the Earth, so that instead of being the size the pyramid is, if it was the whole width of the Earth, and then you had that 51 degree angle at either side, the apex of the pyramid would be in the center of the moon. So it's the exact distance between the Earth and the moon. It has a ratio to that, an exact ratio to that. And this the year and pi is basically expressed throughout the measurements of the pyramid. Now, I don't know when it was that the Greeks came up with the idea of pi, but whoever it was that designed the Great Pyramid, he already knew about it in 2600 BC.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think how they would come with or just discover that in nature.
Well, as you say, I mean, they could have worked out this inch from somewhere else that they had, and the royal cubit. They could have worked that out from something else, but to work out pi, and you have to be pretty clever to work that out. I would have thought, work it out that it's 3.1 1.4 or whatever times the radius is actually gives the circumference of the circle. I am no good at maths, so this is all new to me.
I think it's. I would say that's more to do with geometry, and understanding shapes, and then finding the relationship between shapes, and then it would be a matter of just noticing patterns of how you break shapes down and whatnot. And I mean, what this all says to me is I just see design in nature itself, and people are just discovering these formulas. You know, I don't see how a universe which is built on absolute randomness has such design incorporated into it.
Yeah, it's incredible.
People can just deny the existence of, whether you're religious or not, how someone can deny the existence of an intelligent, conscious, intellectual mind, intelligent design, essentially, is kind of beyond me. I don't think I've ever gone down that train of thought of just thinking that it was just randomness.
Yeah, it's impossible. I think things like the Great Pyramid are reflections of the order of the universe, and within the pyramid itself there are two chambers, the king's chamber and the queen's chamber. And in the king's chamber there's what they call a coffer, and it's basically an open casket. There was no lid to it. They claim that it was supposed to be for a body, but as we'll see, it seems likely that this coffer was actually meant for something else. From the measurements of the coffer we find various proportions which include the following: the cubic volume of the coffer's walls, approximately 6 inches thick, and the bottom of the coffer, approximately 7 inches thick, equals the cubic contents, or the volume, that the coffer could hold. The length of the coffer plus its width equals pi, 3.14159, times its height. The diagonal of the inside bottom of the coffer is double its height, or 4 cubits. The diagonal of the inside bottom of the coffer rises parallel to the pyramid's face, 51°51-14.3-. The sum of the length, width, and height of the coffer is equal to 1/5 of the sum of the length, width, and height of the king's chamber itself. And 5 is a special number that appears in the pyramid lots of times as well. The coffer's depth times 2 pi equals the area of its two long sides. The coffer's internal floor has a boundary whose length equals the circumference of a circle of equal area to the coffer's outer floor or base. Several investigators of the Great Pyramid have noticed other unique factors about the capacity of the coffer. John Taylor in 1859 wrote in The Great Pyramid, Why Was It Built?, that the capacity of the coffer is equal in English measures to 128 pecks of wheat, or 32 bushels of wheat, or 4 quarters of wheat. Taylor also pointed out that in his day, when a farmer speaks of 8 bushels of wheat as a quarter, they usually could not answer the question, a quarter of what? Naturally, it is the fourth part of some entire measure, and that measure is exactly equal to the measure of this coffer. And that's quite incredible, isn't it? Because there isn't anything else that actually has that measure. And yet, even today, or 100, 150 years ago, people were still referring to measures that corresponded with the capacity of this coffer. The earliest measures of capacity next to the Hebrew are the Grecian, of which the linear foot is equal to 1.01 of the English foot, or 12.12 English inches. The cube of this foot is contained 40 times in the volume of the coffer. The Roman measures of capacity are closely connected with the Greek and in general assumed the same. The earlier Roman foot is equal to 0.972 of the English foot, or 11.665 English inches. Taking it as equal to 11.66 inches, the cube consists of 1585 inches, which cube is contained 45 times in the capacity of the coffer. Taylor also wrote, as the pyramid coffer contains 18,005,760 troy grains, or 18 million grains, omitting 5,760 grains, equal to 1 pound. So it contains 3,125 pounds troy of 5,700 grains. But this is the weight of water. If the coffer were filled with wheat, the weight would be only £2,500, or one-fifth less. Accordingly, 10 pounds of Troy water would occupy the space of 8 pounds of Troy of wheat. The coffer was probably intended for a corn measure in the first instance, but it was also found that the same vessel, which would hold 2,500 pounds of wheat, would hold 3,125 pounds of water or wine. Hence, any vessel of capacity which would hold 10 pounds of 5,760 grains of water or wine was considered to hold 8 pounds of 7,200 grains of wheat. This was the original, in all probability, of our avoir du poids pound, and that's from the Great Pyramid. Why was it built? Taylor did considerable research on the coffer and concluded that it was a standard of measures of capacity founded on measures of length and the origin of measures of weight for the Hebrews, Romans, Greeks, and English. Taylor's computations were confirmed by Piazzi Smith, who added additional proportions in his work Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid. Not only is the coffer in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid a source of weights and measures, the King's Chamber itself can be shown to be a source of weights for our American silver coinage. Our US silver corresponds in grains to the measures of the King's Chamber in English inches. The silver dollar of the Founding Fathers contains 412.5 grains, the exact length of the King's Chamber. The half dollar contains 206.2 grains, the exact width of the King's Chamber. The silver quarter dollar contains the same number of grains as the number of inches of half the width of the King's Chamber, or 103.1 grains. Finally, there is an amazing relationship between the coffer and the sacred Ark of the Covenant of the Biblical Tabernacle. The cubic capacity of the coffer is found to be equal to that of the Ark. The measure of the molten sea, the great brass bowl held up by 12 brass oxen in Solomon's temple, is equal to exactly 50 times the capacity of the coffer. These proportions are highly significant when one considers the fact that the coffer and the Great Pyramid were constructed over 1,000 years before the Bible was written. Thus, the builders of the Great Pyramid could not have used the Bible for the design of the coffer or the King's Chamber. So you've got a lot there. I mean, it shows that these weights and measures that were used today, there were still that this was the origin of them, and this could very well have been the equivalent of our exact weights that we have, that we take all our other weights from, that we have them in Greenwich, I think they are. The exact weights, it's like the equivalent of the nuclear clock. They've got to get everything exactly right. And this may well have been the origins of that. And then you've also got this connection to the Ark of the Covenant as well, being exactly the same size.
Yeah, quite interesting that parallel there.
I mean, it's complicated stuff. I do find it difficult understanding numbers. I just hope that our listeners can understand it. I'm sure most of them are probably better with numbers than I am. I was talking about these proportions there as well, and you were mentioning geometry rather than arithmetic, and just some more on that. An example of the symmetry of mathematical proportions in the Great Pyramid is found in the measurements of the King's Chamber and the Antechamber. Their dimensions show that the width of the King's Chamber equals half of its length. The height of the King's Chamber equals half of the diagonal of its floor. The length of the granite portion of the antechamber floor is equal to half the width of the King's Chamber. The length of the granite portion of the antechamber floor multiplied by 5, a special pyramid number, equals the solid cubic diagonal of the King's Chamber. The length of the granite portion of the antechamber floor multiplied by 50, which is 2 sacred cubits, equals the length of the side of a square, the area of which equals the area of a triangle of the shape and size of the pyramid's right section. The length of the King's Chamber multiplied by 25, which is 1 sacred cubit, equals an even 100 times the length of the antechamber's granite floor. If the length of the granite portion of the antechamber is multiplied by an even 100, and this length is taken to express the diameter of a circle, the arc of that circle will be found to equal the arc of the square base of the pyramid. The height of the antechamber multiplied by an even 100 equals the base side length plus the vertical height of the pyramid, and the antechamber length multiplied by 50 equals the vertical height of the pyramid. So you can see there that must have been the way that they did this. Somehow it was all to do with fractions and ratios rather than measurements, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, these principles you kind of learn in design, art and design today, and there's just principles that you go by that just resonate with you. It's the same with sound frequencies as well. Like, for example, in art, we learn one thing I was learning. It was the rule of thirds, for example, which is linked with Fibonacci sequence and that. But the rule of thirds is where you break up the page into threes, and you've got, say, like if you're taking a photo, you've got like a rectangle, and then it's broken down into nine squares in total. And then where you get the lines are the intersections. You put your focus point on one of those intersectional lines, and it always makes for a better photo. And these certain rules of composition have kind of stood the test of time, and these ratios. And if you're gonna take a photo and you want to, and you've got a certain subject, then you instead of, like, for example, a group of three is a lot more desirable than a group of four, and then a group of five or seven for it. It's just this, and these images, these things resonate with us on a certain level, and then the same principle carries on over into sound as well, I think, sound design. So these universal principles kind of just resonate with us, and I think somehow they discovered them and tapped into them, and that's why they're still so common today, because they are just universal principles.
Harmonious proportions, isn't it? I mean, that we find them pleasing. This is why we swap from the square screened televisions to the widescreened ones, because that fits in with the golden section. That's why it's better to watch a rectangle. And the golden section does fit into the pyramid as well. The golden section, when worked out, turns out to be the cosine of the angle of the Great Pyramid, expressed as correct to three decimal places, namely 0.618. In other words, the ratio that the distance from the centre of the pyramid's base out to each of the four sides bears to the oblique height of the pyramid's faces is precisely the architect's golden section or number. And then it goes into explaining what you've just explained there, which you explained it a lot more easier to understand than it does here. So the golden section was encoded into the pyramid, pi was encoded into it, and the exact length of the year was encoded into it. And not just the exact length of the year, because as I say, when we look at the post holes that were actually sunk into it, so you've got four post holes at the four corners of the square, and that works like a ball and socket. So if there was movement of the pyramid, it had room to move, basically. And if you do a straight line from one of those post holes to one of the other post holes, it's exactly 365.242 sacred cubits, which is the exact number of days in the solar year. But as I pointed out, it was built slightly off. It was deliberately built so that there was a slight angle, so that the sides bowed in. And if you look at the way that these sides bowed in, you get 365.256. So they're very, very slightly off. And that corresponds exactly with the sidereal year. And at the bit where it bows in the middle, it flattens out. And that's where you get that sidereal measurement. But if you actually continued the bending in so that it didn't flatten out there, you would get the anomalistic year, which is 365.259 sacred cubits. And the exact same arrangement holds good on all four sides of the pyramid. So it was deliberately built like that to encode that number into the measurement. And what I'm going through here are the ones that I can explain, because it's far more complex than I'm able to actually try and get across here. I mean, it is just incredible when you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, do we have any idea of how long it took to build?
20 years.
20 whole years for the Pyramid of Giza.
Yeah, 20 years. Wow. They say that it built. That's how long Herodotus says that it built.
That's not actually that long if you consider it compared to some cathedrals in Europe took, you know, longer than that, didn't they?
I wonder what the size of the labor force was like. They probably had a huge labor force of manpower. And when they were building the cathedrals, it was just people did that in their spare time, didn't they? When they weren't working in the fields, everybody got together to help build the cathedral.
Right.
This seems to have been done by peoples that moved into Egypt, built the Great Pyramid, and then left Egypt. And that was their whole point in going there. I mean, we can get into this bit next, actually. Unless I've got one more. I don't think I've got another quote from these books. I think that's all of it there. If I go back to the Great Pyramid Encoded, and we'll have a look at who the builders actually were. To ascribe to a certain personage the actual building or superintending of the building of the Pyramid of Giza has been the object of much research. No archaeological or historical evidence has been found to positively identify the builder. There is a tradition that has existed since ancient times that the builder was Almodad, the eldest of the 13 sons of Joktan, and that's from Genesis 10:26. Almodad, whose name means God is a friend, is described in the Chaldaic paraphrase of Jonathan as the inventor of geometry and the measurer of the earth. Certainly the Great Pyramid was constructed according to a marvellous geometric design. And the paraphrase of Jonathan was it was concurrent with the Septuagint and the Old Testament. So it was written at the time before the tribe of Judah became amalgamated with the Edomites. So it can be trusted, I think, on the whole, although it's not canon, it's not a part of the Bible itself. I guess it's part of the Apocrypha. Peleg, the uncle of Almodad and the son of Eber, or Heber, whose descendants became known as the Hebrews, was also contemporary with the period of the building of the Great Pyramid. And we read of Peleg that in his days was the earth divided. It says that in Genesis 10:25 and 1 Chronicles 1:19. Since the earth is incapable of separation from something else, we must conceive some division of the earth which would not destroy its unity. A division affected geometrically, such as into degrees, minutes, and seconds, would be applicable to the expression, was divided. The location of the Great Pyramid, which divides the land surfaces of the world into equal parts, all the land east of the meridian on which the pyramid stands being equal within the limits of computation to all of that to the west of it, is a physical application of that expression. Almodad and his family came from the area that we now know as Arabia, and it tells us that in Genesis 10:30. And this is consistent with the records of ancient historians who reveal Arabia as the eastern territory from which the builders of the pyramid came. We have to be careful here not to think that these people were actually Arabs. The land itself was called Arabia, and it was named that after the Arab people, who were a mixed people. And the word Arab itself means to be of a mixed race. And the whole point of having somebody named Almodad who can name his ancestors is to prove that he was not of a mixed race. It was somebody directly descended from Noah. So although they came from the area of Arabia, they were not Arabs. Job, the youngest brother of Almodad, has also been mentioned in connection with the building of the Great Pyramid. In the 38th chapter of the book of Job, the Almighty speaks to Job as if he were the identical person who had laid the measures of the pyramid, stretching the lines upon it, set its foundations in their sockets, and laid the cornerstone. It appears the object of the passage is to convince Job of his incompetency to judge and understand God. The address seems to sound as if the Creator intended to say to him, "You laid the foundations of the great structure in Egypt, but where were you when I laid the foundations of the far greater pyramid of the earth? You laid the measures on the pyramid in Egypt, but who laid the measures of the earth and stretched the line upon it? You fastened down in sockets the foundation of the pyramid in Egypt, but whereupon are the foundations of the earth fastened? You laid the cornerstone amidst songs and jubilations, but who laid the cornerstone of the earth when the celestial morning stars sang together and all the heavenly sons of God shouted for joy? The image is unquestionably that of the Great Pyramid, and it is suggestive that it was the builder of that pyramid who is thus addressed. Another personage whose name is often linked with the building of the pyramid is Enoch, who lived for 365 years, and perhaps to be more exact, since there are 365.242 days in a year, 365.242 years, the value of the solar year. The Great Pyramid has been referred to by ancient historians as the Pillar of Enoch. Bible chronologists, however, have established that Enoch was no longer living on the earth at the time of the building of the pyramid. Josephus, the 1st century AD historian, referring to the descendants of Seth, wrote, "They were the inventors of the peculiar sort of wisdom which is concerned with the heavenly bodies and their order, and that their inventions might not be lost before they were sufficiently known, they made two pillars, the one of brick, the other of stone, and they inscribed their discoveries on them both." Josephus goes on to state that the pillar of stone remains in the land of Syriad to this day, and he was writing in between AD 37 and 95. Syriad would indicate the Syriadic or Sirius worshipping land of Egypt, where Sirius was venerated as the star of Isis. The identity of the builder of the Great Pyramid remains one of its hidden secrets. We may conclude, however, from the available evidence we have, that a descendant of Shem, a Shemite, was its builder. It is noted that they were descendants of Enoch, to whom God has given revelations concerning the times and cycles of the heavenly luminaries, and from Noah, who had received special revelations in the sciences of measures, mechanics, and all the superior wisdom embodied in the Great Pyramid. And I would suggest, and that ties in with this explosion of civilization happening just after the time of the localized flood in Sumer, because the people that built these civilizations, they must have had parts of this knowledge. They must have known about the ratios and a measurement and how to do these things. And that tells us that Noah had these ideas, or Noah understood these things, because he's told about them. I mean, that finishes these quotes here, but there's also a secondary part to this, because we're told that what happened was a group of people called the Hyksos came into Egypt, and the Egyptians accepted them as their overlords without putting up a fight. There wasn't any battle between them, and they accepted these people that came in. And it was these people that came in who they called the Hyksos, which translates as shepherd kings. And they were the ones that directed the Egyptians to build the pyramid. And once they had built the pyramid, they left. And it's very strange. That's why we get this bit that's telling us that they came from the east, which we now know as Arabia. And these people were known as the Hyksos. And then about 1,000 years later, there is an invasion of another people, and they were made up of Canaanites and sea peoples, and they are also referred to as Hyksos, because it seems that that was sort of the equivalent of foreigners, because these were the first guys that came in, they called them foreigners or Hyksos, and then when the second lot came in, they called them foreigners as well, but they weren't the same people, they were different people that came in the second time.
Yeah, I think it's a term, I think there's a quote from Josephus, which basically states them as being foreign rulers, people that came from foreign lands and ended up ruling. So I think there's something in the word Hyksos, which essentially is just a sentiment more so than a label.
Yeah, and it's based on the fact that shepherds were seen as an abomination to the Egyptians, people that actually kept flocks or herds. They saw them as being an abomination. And that would have included most other white people. I mean, it does make you wonder, well, what were the Egyptians themselves eating if they didn't keep herds or flocks? Or did they rely on other peoples to keep the herds and flocks and then purchase their food from them? Because they weren't vegetarians or anything like that.
No, interesting. They had, well, do we know anything about their diet? We know they had grains, because of the story of Joseph and a lot of the grain that they stored. in certain parts with the drought, that they used it all up.
Yeah, we'll get into that when we probably in the next episode, actually. We'll get into that. I'm just trying to see if I can find some more about the Hyksos here and the people that built the pyramid, because I was reading from the smaller book, and there is I've got this larger book here, which is a study on pyramidology, and that also has a piece on it, and it might have some more information that I actually missed. I did look these I've been going through this and trying to find the best bits to actually read out, but I'm not sure where this part is about who built it in this larger book here. So here's an extra piece about these Hyksos people here. Manetho, the Egyptian priest and scribe, is quoted by Josephus and others as saying, "We had formerly a king whose name was Timaeus. In his time it came to pass, I know not how, that the deity was displeased with us, and there came up from the east, in a strange manner, men of an ignoble race, who had the confidence to invade our country and easily subdued it by their power, without a battle. And when they had our leaders in their hands, they demolished the temples of the gods. This king Timaeus of Manetho may have referred to Cheops, during whose reign the Great Pyramid was built." Manetho continues, "All this nation was styled Hyksos, the shepherd kings. The first syllable hik, according to the sacred dialect, denoted a king, and the sos signified a shepherd, according to the vulgar tongue, and of these is compounded the term Hyksos. Some say they were Arabians, and that's because they came from the east. Manetho wrote about 300 years before Christ, and some authorities hold that Manetho mixed up the history of another set of shepherd kings of a much later dynasty. However, the ground of his story belongs to the period of Cheops and the Great Pyramid, for it was then that the events he relates occurred, the control of the reigning sovereigns by a shepherd prince, the temples being closed, the gods destroyed, and the people pressed into labour for the government. Archbishop Usher, the noted church historian, in his chronology, refers to the migration of the shepherd kings from Arabia into Egypt. From Usher and other authorities, it seems that some shepherd prince coming from Arabia or Palestine was enabled to exert such an amount of mental control over King Cheops as to induce the king to shut up the idolatrous temples and compel his subjects to labour in the erection of the Great Pyramid. Under this shepherd prince, Egypt's national religion was overturned in favour of the more simple worship of the one true God." And I don't know where he's getting that from, that they would have forced the Egyptians to worship the God that they were worshipping. They shut down the temples, but I don't think it says that they forced them to worship another God. "Upon completion of the Great Pyramid, ancient writings of the historians say that the foreign people withdrew, and their departure was the cause of great rejoicing among the Egyptians. The restraint being removed, the people returned with fresh zeal to their idolatrous practices. Because chronology and the findings of archaeology have established the date of the start of the building of the Great Pyramid to 2623 BC, many Egyptologists have disputed the Hyksos identity of the builders. They have labelled a much later date for the invasion of Egypt by the Hyksos and assigned a period of 1800 to 1500 BC as their domination of parts of Egypt. However, it is generally agreed that the beginnings of the Hyksos control of Egypt are obscure, and that during the period of the 3rd and 4th dynasties, the Egyptians furnished the labour for the erection of several pyramids, culminating in the Great Pyramid." And this is why I say there was two lots of Hyksos, basically. They were different people. It was much later on that we had this other group of Hyksos, which actually took over Egypt and were resented by the Egyptians. And they certainly weren't great builders or great engineers or great mathematicians or artists. They were a particularly harsh people. They did actually have chariots, but we'll get into all of that when we are discussing Joseph. But is there anything else you want to add to what I've just said, or anything else that we've been talking about today, Patriarch?
Not really. I mean, it's all very new to me. So other than some of the common themes that I know about and understand in terms of the design and and universal kind of principles. There's not much I can add, really. Just soaking it all up, and I think next episode should have more to understand and relay.
Well, yeah, I wanted to bring this up because it's information that most people aren't aware of. And you hear about the pyramid, and people talk about, oh, well, a pyramid shape, you can put some meat in there and it won't rot. Or you can put a coin in there and it cleans itself up, or it's got magnetic properties, weird things like that. People don't often talk about the actual geometry of the pyramid itself and how that corresponds to, you know, the distance between the Earth and the Moon, the exact size of the Earth. I mean, it's also encoded into it the exact weight of water, the exact weight of the Earth. And then you get the passageways themselves, and there are marks on the passageway which correspond to important events in the ancient world. So as if it was a prophecy built in stone. From when you walk in through the passageway, that's from the year when it was built. And for each pyramid inch that you go in, that counts for a year. And you can see that there are markings of when these important things happened that obviously were happening in the future, basically. Yeah. So it's like, and the Bible prophecy is that it will be a witness in stone, a monument that will be a witness to God. So it's like a witness to events in the future, and also a witness to the creation of the Earth and all the ratios that there are between it, and the weights and the measures. And I do think that coffer was used as the standard for weights and measures. I don't think it was intended to be a coffin. Oh, and the other point is, there are two shafts which go into the pyramid, air shafts. And if it was supposed to be a tomb, it would need to be completely sealed, so there was no air that was able to get in. And the two shafts of air that allow the air in, it means that the temperature inside there is the mean temperature of the Earth. And that is supposed to be the most conducive temperature for people to live at as well.
I mean, there's been a lot of theories of what the pyramids were about. I mean, I remember learning in school they were obviously burial chambers, and then them shafts were there to project the soul or spirit into towards the stars, right? So there's that theory. Then I remember years ago, maybe a decade ago, learning about the Great Pyramids being a kind of power generator and built in such a way to incorporate the Nile at the bottom. And due to the limestone reacting with it, it created this charge. And so obviously there was them theories. It was almost essentially like an ancient power station. So what are we proposing that the pyramid's actual use was? Was it simply just a testament to God and like a grand kind of iconic building, a symbol, or did it have an actual use?
I think it was a monument. It was a monument to God, basically, proof of God. I mean, how could somebody know the size of the Earth and all these ratios and measurements? And it's impossible to know. Instead of having hieroglyphics there telling people what they were doing, and instead of having images there of things to show people their interpretation of it, it was basically showing all the geometry, and built in such a way that we weren't able to build anything to that height again for thousands of years. And we didn't know the distance between, you know, we didn't know the circumference of the Earth for thousands of years, or the distance between the Earth and the Moon. And the what was actually encoded into it, the information that was encoded into it, is just incredible. It would be difficult to work all that information out today, and let alone to actually build it as well. You think all those blocks were 2.5 tons. I mean, how were they going to get the capstone up there to the top anyway, once it had been built? And you think it was all encased in limestone as well, as I was saying last week, with this glue that they couldn't even make now, that was so thin. And this limestone would have reflected, and they reckon you would have been able to see it from the Moon. the reflection of it, and it would have lit up the whole of Egypt, basically. It would have been like a giant sundial. Just an incredible piece of engineering. And to think the people that built it just moved into Egypt, and, you know, without firing a bow or without using a spear, the Egyptians just obeyed them, and they built this thing, and then they left.
Yeah, that is quite bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that sounds almost like it could potentially be, you know, the sons of God that we talk about in Genesis, and they came and they passed on technologies and taught women the colour of rouge and how to use weapons and warfare. Do you think that there's any potential connection there?
I don't think there is, because they were the fallen ones and they were teaching us things ahead of our time. Whereas when you read in the Bible, you hear that there were angels that walked the earth at this time. You know, there were angels that walked the earth and that ate dinner with Abraham. And then when you look in the Vedas, they talk about deities that walked the earth at that time. It was the age of gods and kings. Whereas in the Bible, it talks about it being the age when angels walk the earth, the angel of the Lord. So they could, that, you know, that could have played into it as well. Mm-hmm. It's just referred to as in a different way, I think, in the Vedas. And also, I think in the Greek myths, they talk about the gods walking the earth, and those gods would have been angels, either angels of the Lord or the fallen angels that we talked about were more than likely the Anunnaki from Sumeria, the ones that talked about creating the different races and the black-headed people and mixing it all the different kinds together, which is, of course, forbidden in the Bible, and that was the reason for the flood. So you had these fallen angel types, and you had the angels of the Lord that were around at this time, and plus it was the age of heroes and the age of kings. So I think it all ties in together. I mean, who knows where these people are today? But I don't think they were the bad guys that built it, because, as I say, I think it's a witness to God, basically. That's what that's what the Bible says. And then when you tie that in with the prophecy, these lines that are marked on the passageway that correspond with the birth of Christ and the crucifixion, the Exodus, the Passover, all these things are marked on there at the exact time. When you use the inched as a representation of a year, walking in from the passageway from when you go in. I mean, I specifically haven't really gone into that side of it today. That's something else that maybe listeners can research for themselves. But that ties into it as well. And that implies that it's of God rather than being of the fallen angels, I would suggest.
Yeah, true.
Anyway, we'll leave that here, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, listeners. Thank you. For listening, we will be back in 2 weeks' time, I think, because it's the Patriotic Alternative Monthly Update next week. So we will see you in 2 weeks. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.